From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and what time is it? It's showtime! Stick around for my interview with music legend Sheila E.
To be all that I am is all the genres of music. It's Latin, Latin jazz, salsa, it's R&B funk, it's rock and roll pop.
And we hear from an opera singer who learned by watching soaps.
I went to UNLV. We have no acting there. But I did watch a lot of telenovelas as a kid, so maybe that's why I'm able to emit much more, a lot of emotions.
Plus, a North Carolina soccer team beats the odds on and off the field in a new reality TV show, and Bomba from Puerto Rico makes its way back to the streets. All this and more coming up on Latino USA as we talk to the people and artists who are under pressure and on the spot. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and it's showtime, mis queridos. Today, people in the spotlight, under pressure, and taking the stage. And we begin with an artist. The curtain at New York's Hunter College Playhouse rises on a 19th century French ballroom. Ladies in Victorian gowns and noblemen with carefully groomed dreadlocks toast and dance. Black, Asian, Latino, and white performers are all members of the French gentry. Every year, the Martina Arroyo Foundation supports a select group of diverse performers in their first operatic roles. This year, they're featuring La Traviata by Giuseppe Verdi. La Traviata, or The Fallen Woman, tells the story of Violeta, a courtesan who gives up her life of pleasure after falling in love with the well-born Alfredo Germont. In this performance, Mexican-American soprano Cecilia Lopez plays Violeta, and we hear the story of how Cecilia came to the opera.
I grew up in Idaho working in the fields with my mom, and so we would hoe beets in the long, hot days in the summer, and we were so bored that we had nothing to do. So my mom, she was the one that would... she would sing música ranchera, Pedro Infante, all of the old classics. Hermoso cariño, hermoso cariño, ya estoy como niño, con nuevo juguete, contento y feliz. And so those were all of the songs that I knew before studying opera. Left Idaho to go to Nevada for personal reasons, but it wasn't for music, that's for sure. I got married, and life happened, and then I was actually studying to be a surgery assistant. I was working in the medical field, and my husband was the one that said, you know what, forget this medical stuff. Why don't you pursue something that you actually like to do, that you have a passion for? And I thought, music? Why? It doesn't pay the bills. I really wanted to be a performer, and I don't know how consistent that is, so I'll just be a music teacher. And that never happened. And now I'm here saying, living everything that I didn't think I could do.
In Act Two, a weak and sickly Violeta weeps and swears her undying love to Alfredo before leaving him for the good of his family name.
When I was at Opera San Jose, our mentor there is Irene Dallas, who was a big mezzo-soprano back in the day. When she called me into a meeting one time, she goes, Cecilia, did you go to acting school? If so, what school did you go to? And I looked at her and said, Miss Dallas, I went to UNLV. We have no acting there. But I did watch a lot of telenovelas as a kid, so maybe that's why I'm able to emit much more, a lot of emotions. Cute story. My mom, she was visiting me in San Jose, and I took her with me everywhere. She would go to rehearsals with me and saw our long rehearsal processes. And then one night we were getting ready to go to bed because it was opera singers have long hours. And then finally my mom goes, Mija, entonces la ópera es un trabajo? Es un trabajo de veras? I go, so this is a real job? And I'm like, yeah, Mom, it's hard. And just to hear you actually question and see everything that I do is really special to me. So ever since then, she's really come to appreciate everything that I do now more. So she knows when I tell her I'm rehearsal, she's like, okay, al rato te llamo, I'll call you later.
And Alfredo finally reunite on her deathbed. Violeta falls to the ground and dies in Alfredo's arms, prey to a terrible disease. The critics have called Cecilia an alchemist of song, and her performances shimmering, virtuous, and cool. This fall, she'll perform leading roles with Opera Idaho and Opera San Jose in California. Sometimes being put on the spot can lead to something unexpected, something ultimately wonderful. That's what happened to comedian Ernie G. He tells us how he found his true calling in the moment.
My name is Ernie G, a.k.a. Ernesto Tomás Grichevsky. I'm a Mexican-American, Puerto Rican, Russian, and French Catholic Jew. I am this country, gosh darn it. And I am a Latino comedian, an empowerment youth speaker and author, and committed to transforming the world for Latinos and transforming the perception that people have of Latinos. So what I do, I'm an empowerment comedian, which is actually a phrase that I coined several years ago. I've been doing professional stand-up comedy for about 16, 17 years now. But I've been doing this empowerment comedy for about 8 to 9 years. And I was doing my thing in comedy clubs, and I loved what I was doing. It was great. But I always wanted my comedy to make a difference and not just make people laugh, but make people laugh and make people think and inspire people. So several years ago, I got asked to perform for the National Council de la Raza and their annual conference. And my buddy was like, it's got to be clean, dude. There's going to be all these like really important Hispanic people, and it's got to be clean comedy. I'm like, I think I can do like 10 minutes of clean comedy. Yeah, I think I can do that. And so I went up in front of this crowd of like 1,500 amazing Latinos, like, and about 10 minutes into my act, I was right about to finish up, the sound system crashed. And the person producing the event looked at me and he gave me a cordless mic, and he said, just keep going. And I was like, I'm done with my clean material. I don't have any more material that I can do in front of this crowd. So rather than tell jokes, I just kind of told my story about being a Latino whose mother came over here from Mexico and first person in my family to go to college here in the United States. And I made it funny and people loved it. And I was ended up being on stage. The guy kept looking at me, stretch it, keep going, stretch it out. I was supposed to perform for 10 minutes. I performed for almost an hour. It was 52 minutes exactly when they got the sound system back working. And that's where I discovered this ability to make people laugh and to tell a autobiographical, inspirational story. And that's where Ernie G, the empowerment comedian, was born, even though I hadn't coined that phrase yet. So it wasn't like an easy transition. It took me several years to go from telling straight jokes in comedy clubs and in comedy venues to being able to transition into colleges and universities and schools. And it took me about 2 years to get rid of all the old material and start doing this empowering and inspirational stuff. Everywhere I go, everywhere I perform my empowerment comedy, I find that communities of color are not getting the support that they need to not only get into college, because getting into college is great, but the retention of students, meaning that they get the support that they need to stay in college, isn't happening the way it should. And so the Hispanic Youth Symposium was a 4-day conference where these students came and they were truly empowered. But the thing that distinguished the Hispanic Youth Symposium was that we truly, genuinely transformed what students believed about themselves. It wasn't just, hey, this is how you write an essay, this is how you fill out the financial aid FAFSA form. It was, who you are is a beautiful, powerful, educated person. And students fell in love with themselves, realized that they were much more beautiful than what the world is trying to tell them that they are. So we tell students, listen to that still small voice within, that you know who you are, the way your grandma talks to you, the way that your favorite tía or tío or cousin or uncle, the way that they adore you, that's who you truly are. And so several years ago, I was asked to be the keynote speaker at UCLA's Raza graduation. So every year UCLA has a graduation and then they have a Raza grad for the Latino students, you know, with mariachis and pan dulce, you know how we do it. So I went up in front of everybody. And of course, I tell my first joke, which is my classic old school joke that Latinos, no matter how much education we have, no matter how much money we make, no matter how much affluence we attain, if we grew up in El Barrio, we will always have a little ghetto inside of us. Every time I perform that joke, I performed it at Stanford, I performed it at Cornell, I performed it for our troops. Everywhere I perform it, 75% of the people crack up and 25% are like, we're not ghetto. So I say, if you don't like that word ghetto, replace it for survivor. Because if you're a Latino living in the United States and you're successful, then you are a survivor. So you got to love and embrace the ghetto within or the survivor within. But the first thing I do is, of course, tell a joke and get people to laugh, because once you get them laughing, then their hearts and minds open up.
Ernie G is a self-described empowerment comedian. For more information, visit our website at latinousa.org.
And there's no fry on the calling gray Chicago moon, baby, Benny Charlie's born is in the ghetto.
In the ghetto.
And the hard mama cry. For the nifi one, sido, ni modriti en grima o fin de ghetto.
Coming up on Latino USA.
It was the high school boys who came to me first, and each time that they had approached the administration, they'd been turned down.
How a high school soccer team came to be and learned to thrive in a small Carolina town. It's El Nuevo Sur on Reality TV. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Como
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And now a little bit of self-reflection. Latino USA is distributed by NPR, and we are proud to be associated with the quality journalism all of our colleagues deliver there. But there is an elephant in the room, and it's a question that NPR's new CEO and president has chosen to tackle very publicly. Is there a seat at the table for all sorts of people in a public media landscape? And so we asked that president and CEO, Jarl Mohn, to join us to talk about this and much more on Latino USA. So welcome to Latino USA, Jarl.
Thank you.
So let's start off with the question that I raised. How do you plan on pushing NPR so that it really does begin to sound like America and less, look, the critique is out there, less kind of elitist, less white, if you will? How do you plan on doing that?
Well, I think there are a number of things we can do. I do believe that the people inside the organization have been, for quite some time, deeply committed to this whole idea. The organization, the journalists, the people that work there, the managers, recognize it's not just an ethical issue, it's a business issue. If we're going to succeed, the organization on air has to sound like what America sounds like. The first thing that one thinks about with diversity is ethnic and racial diversity, and that's certainly a huge part of it. But there are other things as well. Geographical diversity. I think it's important to have Latino voices on the air and Latino accents on the air. I want to hear Southern accents on the air. I want to hear Boston accents on the air. I want to hear young voices in addition to some of the older, more mature voices. And we also have to have ideological differing points of view as well. So that, to me, diversity represents a lot of different things.
When you talk about diversity making sense from a business argument, and you know that there are so many people who say, well, wait a second, public media is not supposed to be about making money. Public media is supposed to be about serving the public without this notion of it's got to make business sense across the board. What do you say to those people who say, well, we don't understand how you put those two things together?
Well, first, I think it's exactly the same thing. When I say it makes good business sense, let's take the money out of it first. It has to do with the vibrancy and the vitality of the organization reaching an audience. Now let's shift to dollars and cents. It's no secret the organization, NPR, has had some financial difficulties lately. The good news is we think that most of that is behind us. We're going to have a break-even budget next year. I'm hoping that the year beyond we're going to have margins, which will give us the opportunity to invest more in programming and content. We can't do that. We can't have a successful financial business if we don't represent what's happening to the country. The country is changing.
We talk a lot about diversity in terms of the United States, but what about the international coverage? Are there plans to reinvigorate coverage of Latin America in the future? Is that one thing that you're thinking about?
Yes. I actually met with the two people that oversee our international coverage. Edith Chapin and David Sweeney last week. We spent an hour and a half together. I wanted to understand from them the current state of affairs. The realistic answer right now, first, we have to get the business in order. The way I sold myself to the board was to say, this organization has never really focused on going out and raising a lot of money to make sure that it is secure for the next 50 years. That's what I want to do. The only reason we want to do that, the sole reason, is to make sure that the people that are working there can have the tools and the resources and the money that they need to do the best work that they've ever done. So when I met with David and Edith, and we talked about international, I said, where would you like to grow next? And Latin America was the first thing they mentioned, and then Southeast Asia.
Here's a bigger question. How do you think about leadership in an organization like NPR that, frankly, over the last 8 years or so, has had some really difficult times in terms of the number of presidents and CEOs that the company has seen. How do you actually lead an organization that is bruised, where morale is bruised as well?
First thing I did was I made a commitment to the board of directors and I made a commitment to the staff. I've signed a 5-year contract. So we have a legal binding piece of paper that chains me to my desk for at least 5 years. More important than that is my word. And then it's a matter of helping people get the tools that they need and the resources that they need. I think everybody would love if there was some way we could demonstrate that that trauma and that turnover is behind us. The only way to do that is with time. I have to be there. That's not enough because stability is not enough. If I do a bad job, no one's going to want me to stay there. I have to prove myself. If I do that, I do what I'm supposed to do. I prove myself. I demonstrate that I'm a good colleague and I'm a good coworker, and I stick around. We'll know in 5 years.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Sure, thank you.
Jarl Mohn is the new president and CEO of NPR, which distributes Latino USA. And now, a story about struggling against all odds. In the world of high school soccer, you gotta get your head in the game, because it's showtime. Our next guests know that intimately. They're part of a show on Nuevo TV and Hulu called Los Jets. They document the everyday lives and on-the-field drama of the Jordan Matthews High School soccer team. And this team, based in Siler City, North Carolina, is all Latino, in a state that was much more used to all-white baseball teams. Journalist and writer Paul Cuadros is the head coach of the team, and Linda Lopez is the executive producer of the series. And in the interest of full disclosure, we should note, yes, that Paul is the husband of our senior editor, Lita Hartman. Welcome to Latino USA, Paul and Linda.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Paul, let's start with you. Mm-hmm. So you're a journalist. You actually were raised in the Midwest, but you were hardcore investigative and kind of a numbers guy. And then you end up moving to North Carolina and becoming a soccer coach, writing a book about it that is now a reality.
Right. Well, the numbers are what really brought me to North Carolina because in 1998, just by researching the census data and understanding the food processing industry, the chicken processing industry, the hog processing industry, you could project ahead with those numbers as to what was going to happen to these communities that had a slaughterhouse in them. And so even in 1998 and 99, I could see that little towns like Siler City were going to be completely transformed by the workers that were coming to work in those plants. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. Along the way, because I moved to a rural community, I had to find something to do. And so I began coaching, and it just sort of became this thing, became this story.
You were working with an all-Latino team. It was a soccer team in a state that was really not so used to Latinos, not at all used to soccer, frankly. And there was a lot of resistance.
Well, absolutely. So it was the high school boys who came to me first in about 2000 who had been petitioning the school and the school administrators to form a program, a varsity program at the high school. And each time that they had approached the administration, they'd been turned down. And so I decided to get involved, which is something that most journalists don't do. But I didn't think it was going to be that big of a thing.
So, Linda, you are a journalist as well. Now you're an executive producer. And of all of the stories that could have been told for Nuevo TV that is trying to reach this young Latino demographic and broad audience, why did you choose to focus on Los Jets?
Well, first of all, because what we do at Nuevo is do what you don't see mostly in our media, which is tell the real stories of Americans who are Latinos. That's our first goal, and we want to definitely make sure we do that. But also, we felt so passionate about this story because I believe that this is the show, this is the docuseries you want to see if you want to have the correct conversation about immigration in this country, about lots of issues that are important to Latinos. And so we feel like it's a very real-time story. It's a very modern story, and that's the one we want to tell.
You did have a particular issue around the fact that some of these kids are undocumented. So they only go by first names. For example, Darwin, right? Or Martin.
Darwin is our top striker. Last year, he had the most goals of anybody on the team.
And he plays rough and tough.
He's crazy. He's unstoppable.
Darwin is a very serious and intense kid, and I know other teams fear him. He is like a bull out there.
We call Martin El Chino.
Martin looks like he's from China, but he really isn't. We just like to mess around with him.
He has a lot of excellent instincts for the game.
Come on, Martin. This year, as producers and journalists, you also had to say, wow, we're about to put, not just for a few minutes, but for several hours on national television, young people who are here without papers. How did you guys talk about that?
One of the ways we dealt with that was that the players that are focused on who don't have papers have deferred action for childhood arrivals. This is the program that the president initiated about a couple of years ago to provide a legal residency status for kids who are dreamers. And that allowed them to get a Social Security number, to get a work permit, and to be more integrated in the society and to not have to worry about deportation.
But even saying that, it's so brave of Jonathan, especially, for example, or Darwin, to tell their stories and make sure their stories are shared. Here's very logically, you see, in a very common sense way, why would people come here? Why would they go through this? And then, more importantly, what are their lives like after they get here? They are these great citizens. They are these great kids who become stars on their high school soccer teams, who grow up and have sons who are stars on their high school soccer team. And it's about that story, the telling of that story being important enough to want to take those risks. So I so commend them for how brave they are.
Paul, there's something that you've written about, this notion of people being born American. Mm-hmm. Wherever they're born. They're born American, but they may be born in Bangladesh. They're born American, but they may have been born in Lagos, Nigeria. They're born American, but they may have been born in Lima, Peru. What is this notion of you can be born American anywhere?
Well, you know, I think that, I mean, that's the idea of America. So that's the fundamental thing that makes us all Americans. And it's not, you know, papers, it's not the citizenship, but rather it is the feeling inside of you that you want to be free, that you want to control your own destiny, and that you want to live your life the way that you want to live it. And people feel that way all over the world. They may never get a chance to actually be able to express that in their lives, but if they come to this country, they do have that chance.
Well, congratulations to both of you, Paul Cuadros and Linda Lopez.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Paul Cuadros coaches Los Jets, the soccer team featured in a new TV show, also called Los Jets, which is on Hulu and Nuevo TV. Linda Lopez and her sister Jennifer are executive producers. And now, we shine the spotlight on Austin, Texas, and specifically the Tejanos of Austin, Texas. Many Latinos there can trace their roots back hundreds of years, back to when Texas was part of Spain and later Mexico. They're not Mexicans or Anglo-Texans. They are Tejanos, and they're proud of it. A six-mile path through Austin aims to preserve some of the city's Tejano history. Reporter Veronica Saragovia takes us on a tour of the Tejano trails.
Johnny Degollado has been playing the accordion for half a century.
Johnny, tell us where we are.
Okay. We're in East Austin on
Chicón?
Yeah, on Chicón. And right now we're inside the pavilion that the city named it Johnny Degollado Pavilion at Fiesta Gardens, you know, named it after me.
Fiesta Gardens is an outdoor venue in East Austin, a mostly Latino part of the city since the 1930s. Johnny, who's now 78, grew up near here. In 2012, he got a Lifetime Achievement Award from the city's Mexican-American Cultural Center.
Polka.
Wow.
Texas
so
polka.
Beautiful. Texas polka.
Texas polka, yeah.
About a mile north is the house of Diana Herrera Castañeda. It was built in the 1930s and belonged to her grandmother. It's typical of the houses of this Latino community, small, one-story, and made of wood.
East Austin used to be German and Polish and all of that, but then when the city council around 1937, they came up with a new plan to remove all the Mexicanos from downtown Austin.
Diana's family has played a strong role here. Her great aunt, Consuelo Herrera Mendez, is known as the first Mexican-American teacher in Austin. There's a school in the city named after her.
Her first school was two blocks down at Comal and 3rd Street, and it was called La Escuelita. And they had kids of every age in each of the classrooms, so they weren't divided into first grade and second grade. They were all, you know, first graders, even if you were 17. And that's because a lot of the kids just had no education. They were not literate, and they were all learning at the same time.
Diana's home sits right across from some of the nation's first public housing, opened in 1940. It was spearheaded by Lyndon Johnson when he was a senator from Texas. Diana's grandfather owned the land and sold it to the government.
These are the Chalmers housing projects. They were built by the federal government in their yellow brick underneath that stucco they put on it.
Public housing was segregated at the time. Chalmers was for white people. Another project was built for African Americans, and yet another for Latinos. Today, most of the neighborhood is still Latino, for now.
We're trying to keep it that way. Around the alley, back over there, there's a house that was built by an Anglo woman. It's a three-story house. So it kind of feels like an infringement, because if you're in your backyard, you know, they can see what's going on in your backyard. So she bought the house on the end and they remodeled it. So now some more Anglos moved in over there.
My next stop is Zavala Elementary School, about a five-minute walk from Diana's house. I'm on Chicón Street, but my GPS can't handle the Spanish.
Head northeast on Chicón Street, then turn right onto East 4th Street.
Never mind, I get there. At Zavala Elementary, 81-year-old Richard Moya is waiting for me. He went here more than 75 years ago, when most principals were men.
41, the war started. Almost all the men, if they were healthy in a certain age, they were in the Army or in service. So what happened was we had one principal for three schools, Mr. Wilburn. I learned from Lee Wilburn. So he just went from school to school because they didn't have enough principals.
Let's take a little walk down to the...
down memory lane. Yeah, see, the end of that hall was the first grade. And then they just came down second, third, fourth.
Zavala opened in 1936 for the Latinos in the neighborhood. Richard had to come here, even though he lived closer to the Anglo school. That is, until his mother fought for him to switch when he was 8 or 9 years old.
And what were the Anglo kids in that school? They just didn't mix with the Latino kids?
Well, a few of us that were there, no, they didn't like us. I mean, they called us all kinds of names.
Like what?
Well, they would call you Mexican and Pepper Belly. And like to me, they wouldn't refer me by my name. They wouldn't call me Pancho. I guess it was because of reference to Pancho Villa, which is a bad guy, I guess, to some people.
It was experiences like that that led Richard into public service. In 1970, he became the first Mexican-American commissioner in Travis County.
I think Hispanics understand Hispanics better. And if you take somebody like me that grew up in this poor neighborhood we're sitting at, that knows a little bit about what it was like, I don't think that an Anglo candidate from West Austin, if he was to win, would have any idea. And I doubt that they would even come around here.
But the neighborhood is no longer the same as it was when he was growing up. This part of East Austin is becoming a bit like Brooklyn, hipster heaven.
This area here, I think, you know, next 25, 30 years, it'll be gone.
Even you would think like the school?
Well, the school will probably be here, but it won't be full of Mexican kids. It'll be full of some other kind of kids. So we'll see what happens.
Thanks to Veronica Saragovia at KUT for taking us on that tour of the Tejano Trails. Coming up on Latino USA.
When I'm listening to it or when I'm dancing to it, it's just like I transform myself.
Puerto Ricans find their roots through the rhythms of bomba. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Máquina, máquina.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. After many years as a fan, I saw Sheila E. perform this year at the Hispanicize Conference in Miami. And I just gotta say, this woman puts on a show. So it was a particular joy to have Sheila E. sit down with me here in our studios in Harlem to talk about her new album, Icon, and her life in show business. A lot of people don't realize, you know, the breadth of your career. You have played with every big name, from your godfather, Tito Puente,
yes,
to current stars like Beyoncé and Pharrell. The question is, how is it that Sheila E. can be so cool?
You know, it's crazy. You know, I've been able to sustain a career even without necessarily being a solo artist, but really it's just about music and being a musician. This is my 40th year in the business. I can now be the artist that I always wanted to be and was meant to be at the beginning, but the record companies back then wouldn't allow me to be. And that artist is to be all that I am is all the genres of music. It's Latin jazz, salsa. It's R&B, funk. It's rock and roll, pop.
So there was a time when the record companies were saying, what do you mean that you want to incorporate fill in the blank?
Oh, no, absolutely. When I first signed, I signed as an R&B artist. And I said I wanted to incorporate a little bit of Latin and a little bit of funk in my record. And they said, no, you can't do that. You're just going to be an R&B artist. So with Glamorous Life, that was the first single. We fought to get that one released first. They said, you have to be an R&B artist because basically when we take you to the record stores back then when we had them, is we're going to put you in a bin. You got to fit in a bin somewhere. You got to be categorized. I was like, but I'm not just one thing. I'm trying to tell you. When I first went to the record company, you know, it's like I'm a Mexican Creole Indian girl, young girl who wants to play timbales and front her own band and dance and sing. And here's my record. And they're like, what are timbales?
You performed. You were like going crazy on the timbales. And then you walked down into the audience while you were playing.
I just think it's a moment of the audience connects with the music. It's that spiritual moment that we all become one.
You know, as I was listening to your new album, Icon, you know, it's a powerful album in lots of different ways. But the first song that just kind of hit me in the gut was Girl Like Me.
She came to tell me that she didn't feel right. The things that have been done to her in the
abuse, surviving abuse. And I immediately just said, why? Why is Sheila E. writing this song? Is it about you? Is it about a family member? Is it about a best friend? And it's
all of us. Yeah, it is. That's part of what's in the book and my testimony. I've been talking about it for a long time, and still a lot of people don't know, but I decided to write about it as well. Any way that I could reach someone to tell a story to possibly help them, they always feel like, and we feel like, we're the only ones. Until you talk about it in a room of 10 and 7 people in the room have been abused. So I just wrote a song about, there's got to be a girl like me. I know there is.
In the credits on your new album, Icon, one of the credits, I think executive producer actually, is God.
Yeah. I mean, basically, God has created me. He's given me this gift. I give him all the glory and the honor. I cannot take credit for what I do.
Well, clearly your relationship with your God translates into something that is extraordinarily entertaining for the rest of us. Because somehow that relationship allows you to do what you did with one of your other singles from this album, which is Fiesta. And the music video that goes along with it, which is just ridiculous. There you are, hopping in a lowrider. You had the total hip-hop, you know, funk street vibe going on.
We shot all this in Oakland. I said, here's another thing on my bucket list. I've always wanted to have lowrider cars in my video. So I called my cousins, yo, you know, tell Sadface, bring the homies down. Let's go down here and get, you know, yeah, let's do this.
You, Sheila E., embodied like the two
the two coasts of what it is to be Latino. On the one hand, very Chicano, very Mexican from Oakland. Right. And on the other hand, you can't get more New York Afro-Cuban salsa than Tito Puente.
Absolutely.
Can you talk about what that has been to be the unification of both of those things?
It's pretty interesting because that's not how it started. It was East Coast against West Coast. West Coast, we didn't always define the clave in our music. So when we finally came, my dad and I, to New York to play, we came here to play. Tito was always so gracious to us. He never said to me either, had my family, just because you're a girl that you can't play timbales and conga and bongo. No, you can play whatever you want to play. But the other guys and the other players here on the East Coast, they were very rude to us. They were arrogant, rude. And we were not good enough because we were from the West Coast. So because we didn't stick to the clave, you guys don't know how to play. The bands, they would let us sit in. Yeah, come on, beat, Chila, come on. Let us sit in. And then they turned the beat around purposely while we were playing. It was embarrassing. I mean, that was like, why would you just do that to embarrass us? It was, and I felt bad for my dad because Pops was like, he was just excited. We get to play with these guys. We're going to sing. He was so excited. And then you turn the beat around purposely, and then you laugh at us while you're on stage.
When you talk about playing to the clave, just give our audience a sense, if you want to clap it out, what that means.
Okay. So the clave, there's two beats. It's either 2-3 or 3-2. Three, three, so 1-2-3, 1-2, 1-2-3, 1-2. That's 3-2. But I've seen the traditional guys here in New York argue about it every time we play. And they're cursing. And 2 hours will go by and we're still discussing. Is it 2-3 or 3-2? Okay?
And I like yours, which is just, yours is, you were just, what did you do 2-4?
1-2-3-4. 1-2-3. That's it.
That's the funk in you. You know this term ambicultural? Mm-mm. Do you know how they're talking about Latinos being ambicultural and that Latinos can be everything? Do you feel like, are you ready to take on this term of like, I am an ambicultural Latina, I can be many things, and being Latina is the kind of umbrella over which, how do you see it in terms of your identity?
That's what I've always been. Even with the Latin people, early 2000, when it was popular, 15 years ago, whatever, the Latin people wouldn't even accept me. They wouldn't even, the press, the media wouldn't even talk to me. The Latin, our own people would not talk to me. I felt
like— Because you didn't speak Spanish.
Because I didn't speak Spanish, absolutely. And the same thing is like them back in the day. Well, you can't be Latin. You don't know anything about the clave. Really? Okay. Well, then I'm going to just stay on the black side, but I do have, you know, I'm mixed with everything. And that's why I always say I'm a pot of gumbo. I just feel like I belong to everyone. It's a great place to be. It really is. But the foundation of who I am, like I always say, is that foundation of being Latin, my dad, the music. That's the heart of who I am.
Thank you so much, Sheila, for being everything to everyone, because we here at Latino USA think you are fabulous.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Sheila E.'s new memoir, The Beat of My Own Drum, is just published, and her album, Icon, is available now. Puerto Rico is famous for its top salsa musicians. But if you really want to get the party started on La Isla, you gotta play some bomba. It's one of the island's oldest musical forms, combining African, Taino, and Spanish musical elements. But bomba is thriving right here on the island of Manhattan. Roxanne Scott has our story.
Every weekend, booming drums take over the halls of an East Harlem community center. The rhythms sound African, but if you listen closely, you'll notice the singing in Spanish. This is the sound of bomba. In this otherwise drab room, percussionist Nelson Matthew Gonzalez is teaching an energizing bomba dance workshop for men.
You actually take the time and you start doing the steps like this.
Person who hasn't heard bomba, you need to hear it. It's just an incredible art form, the music.
Nelson is a member of the Grammy-nominated group Los Plineros de la Veintiuna. They are one of the best-known bands playing traditional Puerto Rican drumming music outside of the island. They're part of a revival movement that's been growing over the past few decades. It's connecting Puerto Ricans in the U.S. with their multiracial roots.
Bomba is Puerto Rico's oldest Creole genre.
Melanie Maldonado Diaz is a scholar who studies bomba music.
According to oral histories and some other sources, it dates to as early as the 1600s in Puerto Rico.
Bomba was developed by the enslaved Africans who were brought to colonial Puerto Rico to work on plantations. After 1873, when slavery was abolished, bomba became one of the go-to styles of party music in some areas. It was played and danced outside people's homes late into the night. In the 1950s, elements from bomba were weaved into the repertoires of dance bands, especially the band of Puerto Rican legend Rafael Cortijo.
He introduced some of the bomba songs that he grew up hearing that were part of his urban experience in San Juan, in Santurce.
By the 1950s, however, bomba was seen as something for old people. This was now the age of the bikini. Hemlines were creeping up. The long Victorian-era skirts worn by bomba dancers just weren't cutting it for the new generation. The music was relegated to folklore. But starting in the 90s, bomba has come back in a big way.
We're in this era where now bomba has been revitalized and reintroduced to the community as an opportunity for communal practice.
As part of the rebirth, bomba dance groups have popped up all over the place. Milteri Tucker rehearses with her troupe for an upcoming performance. Milteri is Afro-Puerto Rican. She grew up on the island in Ponce. But when she moved to New York, she was perceived as African-American.
Because I made my move from Puerto Rico to New York, I was being called everything except Puerto Rican. And for me, it was then how do I express my Africanness? You know, how do I, within my own culture, we always say that we are a mixture of three cultures, but we only see, like, predominantly one and not the other. And a way for me to go back to my African roots was through learning more about bomba.
In 2008, she founded the Bombazo Dance Company with three dancers. She now has 22 dancers in the company.
I'm connecting to my ancestors through these rhythms. It's a feeling I can't even explain. It's like, you know, I'm traveling back in time for some reason when I'm listening to it or when I'm dancing to it. It's just like I transform myself.
For bomba lovers like Milteri, the annual Loisa Festival in East Harlem is one of the best chances to dance bomba in the streets of New York City. The festival is named after the town of Loisa in Puerto Rico. Loisa is a focal point for Black culture on the island and one of the epicenters of bomba music. Leslie Hernai's family is from Loisa originally. She visits frequently and says it's a great place to be if you're a bomba fan.
At any given time, people would just bring out their drums and start playing, and you'll have a full-on party of just being yourself and feeling the drum and being a part of your community.
This party was founded in the 80s by Leslie's grandmother as a way to bring a bit of her community to East Harlem. And it's working. Smiling faces, food, and dancing fill the streets. Between all the festivals, dance troupes, and workshops, bomba has once again become a major part of Puerto Rican cultural life in New York and in other U.S. cities. Samuel Fajardo, a regular at the Los Plineros workshops, says he sees bomba continuing to grow both here and in Puerto Rico.
Because every time when I go to Puerto Rico, I see a lot of people that they getting into it.
It was a dying art, says Samuel. But now, it's coming back up. For Latino USA, I'm Roxanne Scott. Sin prisa, pero tu lentitud me coleriza. Y es que no brega con Loiza. No, no brega. Me quiere hacer pensar que soy parte de una. For this week's Sabiduría, or Words of Wisdom, we hear from someone who's always under pressure to perform, but not on stage. Tech journalist Janelle Martinez became an entrepreneur when she started her website, Ain't I Latina. Martinez shares the wisdom she's learned in trying to find the balance.
There, to me, is no balance. I remember early on saying, like, yeah, I can't wait till I get that work-life balance. Can't wait till I get that work-life balance. And I, not quickly, but I think I realized at one point that you have to get comfortable with not having balance. Really, you got to get, I think, especially for entrepreneurs, you have to get comfortable with not being in a 100% balanced state. It's not to say that your life is in shambles. Just get comfortable with the fact that, yeah, you're going to have to sacrifice. So you have to just figure out how, you know, what's important to you that day, that week. Still a struggle, but hey, I'm rolling with it. There's a popular saying in tech, fail fast. Essentially, what fail fast means is, yeah, you are going to mess up. You're going to make mistakes, but learn and learn from them quickly. I think with traditional education, it's so easy to feel like perfectionist or being a perfectionist is the way to go. But what are you essentially learning as a perfectionist? But in the entrepreneurial sense, your biggest lessons are learned through failure. Don't wallow and stay in that failure, but learn from it. Get all the lessons that you need to get and move forward.
Janelle Martinez is a journalist and the founder of AintILatina.com. And that's it for this week, mis queridos. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. And mil gracias and farewell to our summer interns, Julia Alsop, Sarah Barrett, and Roxanne Scott. All three of them are students at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. Special thanks to the Martina Arroyo Foundation and the Prelude to Performance Orchestra for their help with our opera piece. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on my Instagram, Maria_la_Hinojosa. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
No, stupid, dumb. We're not ghetto.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring with a Floor Finder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com. And the Cy Sims Foundation, supporting advances in science education and the arts since 1985. CySimsFoundation.org. This is NPR.